97% of executives say that sustainability reporting will be a business advantage within 2 years. And 96% of investors agree that it strengthens financial performance.
Hello and welcome to Off the Books, where we surf the uncharted waters of accounting, finance, risk, and wherever else the waves take us. This episode is brought to you by Workiva, which has been bringing financial reporting, sustainability, audit, and risk teams together for years to help teams provide assured, integrated reporting. It's the warmth of the sun hitting your face on an otherwise frigid day. I'm your host for today, Mike Gravano, recovering cherry coke addict and podcast provocateur. With me is my co-host with the mo-host, Catherine Tsai.
Hi, I'm Catherine. I am a professional asker of questions, and I like to drink venti soy chai lattes. And normally we're joined by Steve Soder, who is our resident accounting enthusiast and Diet Coke aficionado. But this week, he's debiting a conversation with the co-hosts of our sister show, ESG Talk. And they are discussing the 2025 Executive Benchmark on Integrated Reporting.
What does that mean, Catherine? What is that?
Well, essentially, they're looking at the views on assured integrated reporting, which is when you bring together financial and non-financial data and get it ready for assurance. And you can read more about the 2025 Executive Benchmark on Integrated Reporting at workiva.com/benchmark-2025, or you can just listen to our great co-hosts discuss it.
Take it away, co-hosts.
I'm your host, Mandy McReynolds. Today, we're going to have a rapid-fire conversation with our season's hosts, Steve, Andy, and Alyssa. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for having us, Mandy. Always a pleasure.
Yep. We love the team calls.
Love it. So hot off the press, we have our Executive Benchmark Survey. It is a global survey. It's the second year that Workiva has done this. It actually went out right after the conclusion of over 100 global elections. So let's let that sink in for our listeners around the world, whether you're tuning in today from LATAM, APAC, Europe, or the United States and in the Americas. What we know is that regardless of what has occurred in your country or area, we know that the executives are remaining bullish on finance and sustainability data integration happening, despite all the political complexity. So we today want to really unpack for you as the listeners some of our key takeaways of this research as it went out to different executives around the world. Now, when I say executives, I want to be really clear. Many of the individuals that took the survey included over 400 CEOs, CFOs, chief sustainability officers, and chief legal officers to give us some insight as to what the C-suite is thinking. So we'll end with a little bit of conversation on maybe practical ways we can engage with the C-suite on these topics in 2025. So let's just kick it off with our host. I'm curious, 2025 has started off with a pretty big bang from the U.S. inauguration to the omnibus in Europe. So I would love for our listeners to know, what do you see impacting finance and sustainability integration for companies this year? Andy, why don't you kick us off?
I know I did make a prediction last year that omnibus was going to be the word of 2025 around here, and I'm looking annoyingly correct. So omnibus, when it is not being one of the original words for our favorite bus type vehicular transport, actually in this context, it's all about a certain type of European legislation that addresses a range of issues at once with a suite of changes to try and move something forward without having to open each thing one by one. So it's often used across collections of regulation or some kind of big thing. I think one of the previous ones was done for GDPR. Now, obviously, this means law change, and law change means that companies are watching to see what they're going to have to do next. They're talking a lot now about a sustainability omnibus. That means taking a look at what the impact is of what are called the big three European sustainability regulations. Everybody's favorite, CSRD, CSDDD or 3D, that due diligence, and of course the EU taxonomy, which is the classification of sustainability activities. There's been a lot of comment and criticism even about how, because those three were developed separately, there's a lot of overlap. There's a lot of work that has to be done there. So what does this mean for companies? I mean, obviously there's a temptation, and we are seeing this happen, of course, to sit back and say, well, hang on a minute. maybe I should stop preparing for my role in any of these three things and sit back and wait and see what happens with the new regulation. So we do see it impacting companies to the extent that they're saying, oh, hey, hang on a sec. What about my integration project? What about anything I'm doing to improve my processes? But we're also seeing a lot of companies really strongly moving forward. Obviously, phase one of CSRD is ongoing. We are getting reports right now. I am very excited and I'm reading them. And we're also seeing companies acknowledge that even within these discussions, sustainability isn't going away. There's still a strong focus on decarbonization. Reporting and transparency, much as it's not everybody's favorite job, is still acknowledged as one of those requirements that must happen to help move these data forward, to get the finance moving, and to get the investors able to put the money where it needs to be. So it's a really interesting picture. We don't see it. Any of the underlying principles are said to be very safe. So the idea of integration, the idea of raising sustainability to that level, the idea of the quality of data, the fact that all of this is needed, all of that still very, very much stands. So actually, in the long run, I don't see this impacting finance and sustainability integration. I think that is an ongoing move. It's something that will absolutely happen regardless. What we do see is companies wondering exactly what they're supposed to do to keep moving in the short term.
So building off of that, Mandy, one of the things that we also have been looking at globally would be the implementation of ISSB standards in Latin America and APAC. That's a little bit interesting to me because while this is an oversimplification, those standards are promulgated by the IFRS Foundation, not necessarily individual governing bodies of those countries. So you don't quite see the same political interplay that we're looking at, certainly in the U.S., but also in EMEA with Omnibus that Andy just talked about in the EU. And it is interesting in that case, you can kind of think of those as like off-the-shelf sustainability standards. And that continues to march forward. So something that we've been keeping an eye on, but they're kind of marching forward unabated, as I would say. I think you have kind of wide adoption. A lot of jurisdictions are taking those and adopting them as their own. And that to me might be a little bit of a sleeper issue where you're seeing companies go through that process, or excuse me, jurisdiction and countries going through that process. Whereas, you know, 2 to 3 years from now, you know, we may start to see that emerging as kind of potentially the global standard. Of course, I'm always watching the SEC, and pretty much you could take everything that the SEC had done on climate and ESG issues for the last 4 years, kind of reverse it to bring everybody up to speed, as if you didn't remember. But, you know, approximately a year ago, we were all waiting for the SEC to adopt climate disclosure rules, more formal than they had previously. That was adopted. 3 weeks later, went to the courts, and the SEC ultimately stayed it. And I would expect that to remain, as I say, in purgatory, kind of indefinitely. That challenge is still playing out in the courts. It'll be interesting to see if the SEC perhaps stops defending it. They are, at least as far as I am aware. The other interesting thing is that there was on the SEC's agenda some human capital rulemaking that they were expecting to do. That is still officially on the SEC's agenda, although when that gets updated for the spring, I would expect that to fall off. What is interesting, though, is that as we think about, you know, as I said, a lot of things being reversed with respect to ESG disclosures, what hasn't changed is the need to disclose material climate risks, and that's guidance that's actually been around since 2010. I don't think that will change. Actually, if you look at the way that commissioners and other people who maybe were not in favor of the climate disclosure rule that got adopted and stayed last year, I think they have been in favor of material climate risks as that has been written in the 2010 guidance. Again, I don't think that's going to change. Of course, it's always a possibility, but we do have new leadership at the SEC. I wouldn't expect them to be spending a lot of time on ESG issues. But again, to me, that doesn't take away that fundamental requirement that's been in existence for, you know, 15 years now to disclose those material climate risks and their impact.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. And Steve, while you kind of took us global with the ISSB lens, I actually, you know, my thoughts around this are focusing on the U.S. and kind of these state level regulations that we're seeing pop up. I think it is, or not pop up, continue to proliferate and move forward in their path towards adoption. I think it's no secret that you're not going to see a lot of action from the federal government in terms of promoting, you know, climate positive policies or corporate disclosure, right? That's not the federal regulatory environment that the U.S. is going to be pursuing for the next 4 years. However, we're already seeing a plethora of state-led activities really step up and take the charge. And I think, one, this is not unexpected. I think, I don't remember if I said this on this show, but I did have my own 2025 prediction about exactly this. It's no surprise, right? When you see a pullback in a federal regulatory environment, you will often see state-level regulations kind of step up and take the place of that sweeping kind of federal role, as well as just individual companies and kind of industry groups and corporate actors pushing forward that bar and kind of the seesaw of where regulation pushes and then where, you know, a little bit more, frankly, private market pushes. So a couple of things on the state level. One, from just a couple of weeks ago, that the U.S. Climate Alliance, which is this net zero focused group of 24 U.S. state governors, announcing in a publication letter that they addressed to the U.N. Climate Change Executive Secretary Simon Steele, basically saying, hey, we know that the United States has pulled out of the Trump-Paris Accord, but we, these states, are going to remain on track. We are going to continue to pursue policies that push forward towards our climate commitment, our contribution towards maintaining the 1.5 degree warming threshold. And so that doesn't necessarily mean pushing forward with corporate disclosure laws around integrated reporting. However, we do have several states, five, that do have laws on the books, right, about promoting climate disclosure laws in various stages. And so you mentioned, Steve, one, about disclosing financially material climate risk. Absolutely. That's included in all of these state level laws, California climate bills, which are kind of the most famous. These are ones that are passed and are adopted. SB 253 and 261, as amended by this SB 219, that is basically saying that companies that do business in California have to disclose financially material climate-related risks and opportunities, as well as their greenhouse gas emissions. Now, that, of course, is not without its legal pushback. However, just again, a couple weeks ago, we did see a federal judge dismiss two of the charges against that California law. So it's remaining resilient. These charges were basically saying that the law kind of took state level regulation and was accusing it of being extra jurisdictional and acting, you know, against the Constitution in regulating outside of its state boundaries, because it requires companies to disclose not just that are located in California, but that do any business in California. And so I think regardless, you know, that law is remaining resilient. And what we're seeing is these state level laws, it's important to note, they're not actually requiring integrated reporting of financial and non-financial data, right? They're just requiring the disclosure of this climate-related information to various government agencies. I think what we're seeing here is this trend that because there's these assurance requirements in these state-level regulations, that, again, assurance is this piece that really ties the financial and sustainability teams together. That's the integration. It is the application of the principles of financial accounting and transferring them over to climate reporting and carbon accounting, and this requirement for assurance that is bringing these teams together in practice. So my big takeaway here, and I think it maybe took me a little bit longer to get here than I would have liked, so I hope our listeners stayed along with me, but is that while at the state level, you're not seeing mandates for integrated reporting, I think what we're going to see from these corporates is that happening anyway, because you're going to have these teams that are coming together to furnish this data, this sustainability data that has to go through assurance. And the way that you get that data together is by integrating these fundamental principles of financial accounting and reporting into the sustainability data, which requires these in-house teams of finance, legal, risk, sustainability, audit to be working together. And that, frankly, is this whole idea of the value beyond just the disclosure, right? All of the value that you gain from bringing those teams together to deliver trusted information that is going to pass through assurance. So I'll also just for a second put on my Andy Omnibus hat, because when you said this, Andy, it struck me. You know, obviously, we don't have that at the state level, but I do think it's interesting because these state level regulations that we see popping up, while they are, you know, the product of their own state legislature, they are quite similar. They are quite the same. And I think that that's quite intentional, because what you're seeing here is kind of a similar thing of, if every individual state has its own law and then you have companies selling and operating in all these states, they have to do all these different state disclosures. And so thinking about that burden of disclosure, that burden of regulation, I think there is already a very intentional thought, you know, by the states to keep them, these laws quite consistent, so that it is a consistent effort that you are leveraging to meet each individual disclosure requirement.
Thanks so much. And in taking us in this round of the world view, as the survey was, and it was conducted in all the different global markets, what's also interesting about this survey is we have over 220 institutional investors that take the survey, and we do a compare and contrast. And Alyssa, you started us out in a really interesting way where you talked about companies moving forward because of the value creation. I was fascinated by both the short and long-term lens and the compare and contrast of institutional investors to the C-suite and to the executives who took the survey. So I would love us to do a really quick round robin. One, what's one stat that stood out to you around this idea of value creation? And with the like two lines after it, why was it most interesting to you? So Alyssa, why don't you start us off, and then Andy and Steve, you can jump in.
All right, I can already tell that Mandy's giving us the time limit. I feel a little responsible for it, so I'm going to do my best. The stat that was most interesting to me is that 97% of executives say that sustainability reporting will be a business advantage within 2 years, and 96% of investors agree that it strengthens financial performance. And so I alluded to this in what I was just saying prior, but corporate executives' attitude to integrated reporting is very deeply rooted in the belief that trusted, comparable, and assured disclosures will support the long-term financial health of their organizations. This is about disclosing trustworthy information to build market confidence. If I had to boil it down to like the simple layman's terms, it's like knowledge is power, knowledge is value. They want to be disclosing this information because it shows their resilience and their strength. It is a value add, right? It enables better decision-making, and that can improve a company's financial performance.
And my stat builds on really nicely on Alyssa's, because the one I want to look at is the fact that 93% of institutional investors are more likely to invest in companies with integrated financial and non-financial reporting. Now, you might think that Alyssa had just answered that question, which, to be honest, she kind of did. But to build on what she said, the interesting thing about that is the fact that they want to see not only that non-financial data and the financial data, but they want to see how the two interlink. What's the connectivity between those two areas of data? Fundamentally, because as Alyssa says, what we're actually trying to do is communicate and understand the full business value there. So in many, many ways, I think what we're actually seeing here is the understanding that integration isn't just about the physical content of the report. Integration is about what the company's actually doing behind the scenes. And the report is trying to reflect that so that investors can really see that this business has a full handle on its whole operations, regardless of what kind of data might be behind it. So that's why I love that stat, is because it doesn't just talk about the fact that, hey, sustainability is value. It tells you about the fact that it's these two things really need to be working together to give that holistic picture, and not just in the report.
Well, and sticking with the theme of data, my stat is kind of a two-parter. The first is that 92% of investors rank data accuracy as a foundational requirement to effectively evaluate organizations. I don't think that's a big surprise. Candidly, my question is, what were the 8% thinking, if I'm being honest? But so we think about that. 92% of investors rank data accuracy as foundational, yet nearly a quarter of executives don't fully trust their financial data. I was floored, completely shocked. Mandy knows I'm like lighting up the message, like, what? Like, wow, like, really? And then I'm like, wow, did we just get lucky by asking this question? Because I wouldn't have thought to answer or to ask this question. You would assume that number would be much, much lower. And what this tells me is that these executives and their teams are probably going to an inordinate amount of manual effort in order to bridge that trust gap. When you're an executive and you're certifying about data and about internal controls, and by the way, there's other phenomenal stats and interesting stats in the report that actually talk about their distrust of sustainability data as well as the internal controls over both data sets, so I'd suggest you get in there. But if you're an executive, you're going to be certifying as to the accuracy of the data, as to the effectiveness of the internal controls. You have personal and in some cases criminal liability for knowingly certified as to those things if you really don't have confidence in it. And so again, executives aren't stupid. They're going to be going through a ton of effort to close that gap. And so to me, this speaks to the massive opportunity that there is for these teams to be actually doing a lot of the processes that Alyssa and Andy, you just talked about trying to get that cleaned up. Again, I was just floored by this stat. I couldn't possibly believe that it is that high. But I mean, you know, this is an independent survey. The data is what it is. And again, that represents, I think, a massive opportunity for these teams to close that gap, because that's real efficiency, right? There's an opportunity cost in the teams doing that kind of work, as opposed to the other meaningful work, including showing how this work adds value back to the organizations.
Now, I know we all have just geeked out on data, and I know from Andy, like, she and I like to look at the raw data and we run our own pivot tables, or like Steve, like you said, it's a text around like, well, that was really interesting and a surprise that we didn't anticipate to see. Let's get a little bit more practical for those listening in for our audience, and maybe with a little bit of humor, whoever wants to start us off. During this time of change, I always laugh at the rapid fire of news articles people send me, memes, like funny things, or even just thought-provoking positions. And I'm curious from the team, what's been maybe the one interesting thing somebody has sent you at the kick of the year?
So I'm going to follow on here, because the one, there's an artist who draws in one of the papers in the UK. I think it's also a US paper. And she draws Venn diagrams, illustrating the unlikely intersections between news topics and everyday activities. So this is so perfect for our discussion about data. One of her recent Venn diagrams, on one side, she has the European Union and omnibus, I think is one of the things that she means there. And on the other side, she's likened it to a hen party group chat, by noting that both involve a lot of legislative ping pong and budget disputes. So I think I love this one, because it illustrates to me the way that, even though all this activity in the European Union, the uncertainty that it's causing companies, and the constant change might feel like it's a new thing or it's a special issue, I think it's actually really part of organizing any kind of large group of different interests and trying to understand where the commonality lies and trying to get it into a good place. So I am loving that meme. And I think we should be looking a lot more into that center point in the Venn diagram for all of our issues, to try and find what it is that is consistent and clear, because that's where it's really easy to keep acting, pretty much regardless of what's going on the other side of the Venn diagram.
Mine's a little bit different. I don't know. It's making me feel like I perhaps have more separation from my personal life, from my professional life, which is actually surprising to me, because it's certainly not the way it feels to me in my day to day. But I think something that is coming across as interesting to me is that I have groups of, you know, just peers, groups of friends, who are engaging in conversations on this topic, or just the idea of regulations impacting your personal life or things that you engage in a way that you didn't see in the past. And the specific example is secrets out. I go to a lot of concerts. I really like music. And a band that I really like hosting or participating in a festival in a state with, some harsh kind of anti-ESG laws. And that's not usually a conversation that, you know, comes up when you're talking about the music circuit and the scene. And so it wasn't really a meme. There was, you know, maybe a silly Twitter conversation that was shared. But to me, what's standing out is just this idea that we are not entering, but continuing to exist. And I'll say, you know, maybe in an elevated or like evolved environment of these political and regulatory evolutions being more front of mind to the everyday person. And it's, you know, we work in this space, so we are constantly, I'm not surprised, Mandy, that you have folks that are always sharing memes and clips and news articles, and that's absolutely right. But to see these things popping up in my group chats, which, you know, it's a lot of usually sports and, you know, just other just completely unrelated things, I think my takeaway is that we're really seeing more of an intersection and a reality of this regulatory environment kind of impacting us in our daily lives and at home, like more in our personal sphere.
Yeah, and I would say mine is a little more probably thought-provoking, at least for me, maybe not for everybody, and I'll explain why here in just a second. But, you know, for those of us who are, I'd say, maybe kind of like sustainability noobs, I mean, I've been watching the SEC stuff for a long time, but I'll be the first to admit, I generally attack this from a, you know, financial reporting lens. That's my background. You know, so much of the dialogue has been around compliance. So much of it has been around regulation. And we've been watching that. I mean, this crew especially, right, for what, the last, you know, 4 or 5 years and even longer. And it was a LinkedIn post. It was also an article. I mean, all this stuff kind of hit where it was people taking a step back and saying, hey, wait a minute. No, it's never been about compliance. You were getting held up on compliance and regulation. It's always been about the value from the very beginning. And that to me, again, speaking to this audience might be a relatively obvious observation. But for me, that was a light bulb and an aha moment. And I actually think it gets back to the data that we're seeing here in the survey, which is that, you know, regardless of the political climate, regardless of the regulation, people are going forward because it has been about the value and it is about the value. And again, I realize that might sound plainly obvious to those who've been in the space for longer than I have, but that was genuinely an aha moment for me. And I think it's caused a little bit of soul searching for those who are relatively new to the space, who've been thinking about it primarily from a compliance and a regulatory standpoint, having to really take a step back and recognize, no, if we go at it from that direction, we're actually missing out on a lot of the purpose and a lot of the opportunity and a lot of the value that this exercise can bring to organizations. So again, as the ESG noob, that was a definite eye-opening moment for me.
So I think an interesting part of the research is, like we said, the vast majority that took it were C-suite, were CEOs, or there was about 19% or so that were vice presidents. And I would be curious, Steve, building on your point around value creation, I think it was interesting to be in Davos during the World Economic Forum and have these conversations with chief legal officers, chief sustainability officers, and looking at CFOs and their lens on 2025, how they're thinking about it. And I'm just curious, what tip would you have, Steve, to talking to a CFO in 2025, given all the results of the benchmark survey? Where do you think our listeners can zero in? Alyssa, I would love to hear your perspective on where you think people should be talking to the chief sustainability officer, given all the insights that you've read.
Yeah, I think, Mandy, it's exactly that. I think that there is value. Clearly, there is value in sustainability. But again, I think that there has been maybe a little bit of a distraction, for lack of a better word, into thinking about it primarily from compliance and regulation. And to me, this is an opportunity for CFOs to take a step back and actually identify, okay, what is the value? And to rely on the experts in the space who have been thinking about that for a really long time. You know, we were on a call recently with our external advisory council for Workiva, and somebody had made the point, which I thought was really, really good, to be thinking about sustainability in terms of your income statement. What is this doing for profitability, or what is this doing to reduce expenses, or thinking about it from your balance sheet? What is this doing to attract capital or to reduce risk? To me, I think getting back to those fundamental kind of cornerstones of what a CFO should be talking about, number one, it's plainly obvious that you should always be thinking about that. But number two, I think it kind of puts sustainability back to where it really needs to be, which is a true value driver, because it can, because it does. And I think the survey is really highlighting the general consensus that people see it that way.
All right. I know I haven't been at Workiva too long, but Steve and I are already on the same wavelength. I mean, it's not to be too much of an echo chamber, but it's exactly that. I think from the sustainability perspective and interacting with the CSO, sustainability is no longer a cost center. And I think for a really long time, it was actually viewed that way. I remember in my own in-house corporate background, speaking with peers, and that was kind of the view. It was like, well, you don't build revenue for the company. You're not bringing in money. You're spending money, right? You're a cost center. And I think there's been a total shift in that completely, where sustainability is now seen as a strategic value creation center. And that is what's so critical. And so for the CISOs, I think, you know, I imagine that they are all kind of feeling that in a very real way in their companies. And in terms of how to leverage that shift in mindset, working closely with their peers, right? This is such an incredible opportunity for the CISO, the CFO, your chief legal officer, all working in concert together. Because sure, some of this, there's always going to be this regulatory compliance. You have to do what you have to do. But there's this real opportunity that in meeting the requirement of what you have to do, achieving and realizing all of the value, unlocking all of the value behind that, because it is the integration of these teams and processes and data and information, and also the way that these teams think through things, like from a process standpoint. It is the integration of that that is what best positions a company for that value creation and that long-term resilience and growth.
And I think pretty much my job here as the person with regulation in her job title is just to say I absolutely second everything that Alyssa and Steve just said. as the consideration. It feels a little weird because it's kind of my everyday priority, but it does make way more sense to think about these things more holistically and have the compliance flow as naturally as is possible from the value creation and from the perspectives that they just outlined.
Well, thank you all for joining this incredible conversation together as we looked at the research hot off the press, some of the raw data, some insights as we talk with different practitioners around the globe. It's always nice when we can get into studio together and have a fun chat.
No argument here. We love being here.
Yeah, I appreciate it. Always good to see you all.
Thank you so much to Mandy, Andy, Alyssa, and Steve. And thank you, dear listener, for surfing along with us. I'm Mike Ravagno. You heard Catherine Tsai, and this has been Off the Books, presented by Workiva. Please subscribe so you don't miss any of the season's episodes, including the thing we keep saying will come, the biggest reveal of the best accounting movie of all time.
I can't wait. If you like Off the Books, please leave a review. Tell your buddies if you like the show. If you're watching this on YouTube, drop us a note in the comments or feel free to drop us a line at offthebooks@workiva.com. Surf's up, and we'll see you on the next wave.